Today we have on the podcast Greg Ostrin. I had such a delightful conversation with him. He has been sober for 37 years. He is a screenwriter and playwright who resides in California, and he recently put his experience with recovery into a new hilarious comedy that not only explores sobriety, but also toxic masculinity. It is called The Spy Who Went Into Rehab. It opens June 7th at the Pacific Resident Theater in Venice Beach. And we had such an interesting conversation. I'm excited to share it with you. Welcome back to Wellness as a Way of Life, the less is more source of wellness, knowledge, wisdom, and inspiration for modern women and female founders. Here, we teach you why not all wellness trends are for you, how to figure out which ones are, and how to best adapt them for your personal wellness toolbox. I'm your host, Megan Swan. With more than a decade of experience in the wellness industry and on my own personal journey, I will teach you how to tune into and trust your intuition and drown out all the noise. I love to support female founders in the process of building their business to strategically optimize their physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual wellness. I have helped hundreds of women establish wellness as a way of life with my less is more approach. Join me on my mission to make wellness a way of life. Let's dive in. Welcome, Greg. I'm thrilled to have you on the podcast today. Super excited to talk to you about your upcoming play. But first, tell us, how are you today?
I'm wonderful, Megan. I'm coming at you from Pasadena, California, and it is an overcast day, but life is good. So I feel very grateful to be here.
Beautiful. Well, you have many, many years on me in sobriety. I'm at 6 and you're at 37. So you've seen like a few generations of sobriety come the different iterations and expressions of it. And I'd love to hear, you know, a little bit about your perception of that. And then also, you know, what made you to decide to share your experience in this kind of play and a comedy at that?
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, I'm 63. I got sober when I was 27. I got sober in 1987. And my mother, was the first one in our family to get sober. She was her addiction was for prescription pills, which was very common for a lot of people in the 1960s, women especially, because therapy at that point wasn't as widespread as it's become. The so-called self-help movement was still very much in the fringes of the culture. And So I'm an adult child of an addict. I grew up in an addictive household, and drug addiction, especially pills, is a very different experience than alcohol, because it's a very quiet narcotic, you know. So it's not screaming and yelling, it's not big scenes, it's passing out while driving, it's overdosing, it's a more, you know, it's equally terrifying if you're a child, but it's very different. So my mom got sober when I was 21, and I have two younger brothers, who one is 4 years younger, one is 9 years younger, and they have 40 and 39 years respectively. And I had their example, which is why I got so sober as young as I did, which was from alcohol. And I, you know, it's interesting because my experience with it is I basically did drugs and drank from the age of 16 to 27. And by the time I discovered alcohol and drugs, which was in the same year, 1976, I all feel like I was already a full-blown alcoholic, meaning I was a people pleaser. I had zero self-esteem. I was a chameleon. I was a liar. I was a cheat. I would do or say anything to be liked by another person. And I was self-critical, and I was not this enough. I was not that enough. I was not the other thing enough. And pot drugs initially quieted that, that mind. And everybody was doing it. That's the thing. It's, I'm sure I'm old, much older than you. And, in the 70s, everybody was doing every kids were smoking pot all the time, and it was fairly benign and it was part of the culture. And it wasn't really until I got into alcohol in my 20s when I was living in New York that it became more of an escape from myself. And then what happens is you then escape the escape. You drink to get away from your drinking, basically, or you drug to get away from your drugging. So I was an actor at the time, and I transitioned to being a writer when I was 30, and I'd never really written anything. Actually, the first thing I'd written was a one-act play around my parents, my mother's addiction and how it impacted their marriage. But that was the only thing I really did. And so I got involved with screenwriting, television writing, playwriting, writing for advertising and marketing. And we fast forward to earlier last year. And the motion picture industry, the television industry has changed considerably for writers. It's a lot harder for writers to sell scripts. It used to be very easy, but studios don't pay as much money. They want movie stars attached to things. So I was feeling very disenchanted with screenwriting, and I stopped writing for a year. I mean, I should say this, that especially since the pandemic, because of Zoom, I've been going to a meeting every single day. And through AA, I got into a couple other 12-step programs. And what happened for me was the repetition of going to meetings every day, getting back into a fellowship. I discovered the spiritual aspect of the program in a way that I never really had before. And what I find is that, once you connect with that higher power, whatever that higher power is, for me, I finally felt that peace. I felt that happy, joyous, and free thing. And it had nothing to do with where I lived or who I dated or how much money I had or what car I drove or any of that stuff. So I was really able to let go, and I stopped writing for a year, but I was focused on other things. And then so when I was a kid, so the play that I wrote is called The Spy Who Went Into Rehab. And basically, when I was a kid, and I mean all through my life actually, I loved James Bond movies. I thought they were the coolest things in the world. And I started thinking about James Bond as an archetype, and I thought, he's an alcoholic because he drinks all the time. He's a gambling addict because he gambles all the time. He's addicted to cigarettes, and he's a sex addict because he seduces every woman that he meets. And I thought, and he kills people for a living, so he's probably got anger management issues as well. And I just envisioned what would an intake be with James Bond and a drug counselor, just saying things like, "Well, how often do you drink?" "Hardly ever, maybe 5 to 7 times a day." "Do you gamble?" "Only when I'm in a luxurious casino." "Well, how often is that?" "3 to 5 times a week." "Well, do you have sex with a lot of women?" "I mean, only under certain circumstances, such as if I'm in England, if I'm in America, if I'm in Europe, if I'm in a boat, if I'm in a car, if I'm in a gondola, if I'm in a spaceship." So it's just it's sort of the height of addiction. And I thought, and I started to write it, and it became a play. And while it begins as a look at addiction and what that means, the other side of the Bond character, and I really think it's an archetype for most male fictional characters who have dominated the culture for decades and decades, centuries in some cases. It's the idea of looking at the man who feels entitled to do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, however he wants, to whomever he wants, and not suffer any consequences. And so what happens in the play is that he is surrounded by women, the counselor, women of color, non-binary, And they teach him inadvertently how to be a better guy and how to balance that stuff. And I've said to people, it's the most autobiographical thing I've ever written because it addresses every aspect of behavior that I've indulged in my life and didn't necessarily serve me. But it's placed in a comedic context. But it, so the play got produced at a theater in Venice, California, and it ran for 5 weeks. It was sold out. People were, people who were in the program or out of the program, they all related to it. And but it was done as a workshop production. And so the theater, which is the Pacific Resident Theater in Venice, decided that they want to reopen it as one of their official main stage productions. So that happens June 7th. So that's kind of one of the reasons why I just wanted to reach out to the sober community, the wellness community, because the play is, it does, it isn't just entertainment. It really is about what does it mean to come into a situation at an age where theoretically you could say, well, this is who I am. I'm not going to change. And you change everything, which is our experience in recovery. We change everything. There's even that expression, if nothing changes, nothing changes. If you change everything, you change everything. So that's the history of me and the play.
So much to talk about there. So first, what comes up is, it's an identity shift. It's a requirement that you shift your identity because there's so much of our identity built around. In my case, it was growing up in a household of elevated wine drinking, and that, meant something important. And I grew up watching James Bond with my dad, and I've always loved it, but I, kind of put it on the back burner for a decade or two and have recently come back and shown my kids. Sometimes when I'm watching it, I'm like, what am I promoting here, showing this to my kids? And it's this kind of weird rub, right? Because it's so entertaining, and yet maybe it's different for me as a woman, finding it so offensive at the same time. And knowing, as a child, I didn't, I
Right.
just saw it as this ideal, powerful character, and kind of, understood that my dad idolized this character. So I absolutely love that you've taken that spin on it, and that you've surrounded him by women that teach him these lessons. So what was your experience in terms of, unraveling your own toxic masculinity?
I mean, for me, it was a lot more subtle because I think if you'd asked me, am I a misogynist? Do I objectify women? Do I mansplain? I would have said, no, of course not, but once the light was shone on it with all of, it's fascinating, that the Me Too movement, if you want to call it that, and the Black Lives Matter movement, sort of these two cultural shifts happened simultaneously. And working in the entertainment industry, it has been particularly pronounced because, I mean, I work with a lot of younger women and I'm hyper aware of, and again, I'm a man of a certain age. So, it was always accessible. It was always accepted to say, you know what, sweetie, right now we're not going to do that. Or, you know what, hey, honey, can you get that for me? Or dear, or babe, do you mind? And that's a little more pronounced, but there are plenty of men who do that. And I think for me, it was really about my women friends. And one of the things that the 12-step programs has afforded me is a just an amazing assortment of female friends that I'm very close with, and that It's not a romantic relationship. It's not a sexual relationship. It's not a flirtatious relationship. It's a spiritual, it's friends, it's true friendship. And there are perspectives that men bring to the table, and there are perspectives that women bring to the table, and the masculine and the feminine. And so hearing those stories and just like talking to friends of mine saying, so have you been harassed a lot? And they're like, oh, are you kidding? I mean, and harassment can be as simple as the way someone looks at you. It can be the way someone addresses you, the tone, and so I don't know, I think it was, I think I was, I have a daughter. So I have two sons and a daughter, and my daughter is 18, and she's a true Leo. She's tough and she's fierce and she doesn't take any guff. And so she's always been very, since she's been raised in this, gender fluid, empowered time. So she's very quick to call me out if she thinks I say anything that's inappropriate or what have you. So I have it from that point of view. I think it's just being in the culture. And so just learning like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm not overtly sexist. I'm not misogynistic, I don't think, but I get to look at areas where it might come off that way, or my thinking might be that way. Especially in the mansplaining, especially in stating the obvious to somebody. And you can mansplain to other men. You can mansplain to kids, I mean, but I think in terms of my past, sex was as much of a substance for me as drugs and alcohol. And I'm not alone in that, I mean, we all, I think one of the first things that happens in recovery is when you take away the substance. Oh, now I have to get to know this person. What is intimacy? What is physical intimacy? What is emotional intimacy? What is trust? And so I think growing up in a culture where women were objectified and used to sell products, and the women of the Bond movies were, of course, these fantasies. They were strong women for the most part. None of them were pushovers, except for this one guy, but they could fight and, shoot and all that stuff. But I think that's, we're taught as men, well, this is the kind of woman you should be with, because this is the woman that's going to personifies however you're going to feel about yourself, as opposed to, it doesn't matter how someone looks. It matters how you connect with them and how you feel together, and what that is. We're not taught that. I mean, maybe young men are taught that now, but guys of my generation, we were not taught that. And that tends to be a journey that all men, I don't know if you have sons, but
I do.
so that is part of the mother-son dynamic. When I was a teenager, my mother was caught up in the quote unquote women's liberation movement. And so she was discovering her own, even though she was battling addiction, there was another side to her that was embracing her own independence. And she would get on my case if I was disrespectful to girls or referred to them in negative ways or whatever. So, but then I didn't learn from it. I just got pissed off because it was my mom. But that's where the seeds were planted. And I mean, all of the women friends that I have who are moms at some point have to educate their sons about how to be respectful to women, how to treat women. I don't know if it always works, but I know that that's part of it. And it's a man's job as well. It's a father's job as well to model that. They don't necessarily do that, but in theory. So yeah, I mean, it's just looking at all of the stuff, sex. I was never a gambler, I was never a smoker, but the other stuff, and just wanting to look cool, but at the core of that is all, it's all insecurity. It's all fear-based.
Yeah, I was gonna ask. So this intersection, addiction is disconnection. So can you remember back, to the development of your addiction, feeling not really connected maybe to self or to anybody else in a deep way? There was this out, and it happened at a time where you are maybe developing these ideas of what it is to be a man or what it is to be, meaningful, powerful, all these things. And like for you, what is that intersection between toxic masculinity and disconnection?
Well, I think, and again, going back to the James Bond character as a role model, as the idea of, well, this is what a man should be. I mean, my father grew up, he was a kid in the Depression, and he was actually a young man during World War II. So, and he didn't have a good relationship with his father. So my father had no one to model what it meant to be a man. His dad was, this hardworking businessman who was very gruff and had no compassion. My father was a very emotional guy. He was in therapy at a much younger age, and ended up actually going into Al-Anon like the last 20 years of his life. But he was kind of a macho dude in his own way, and I never felt that I measured up, because I actually was athletic, but I didn't like competing athletically. So I went into the theater. I could excel in the theater, because that was something my father didn't do and couldn't do. I could get on a stage, and I was comfortable in front of an audience. I could improvise, I could play parts. So I was seeking fantasy out at a very young age. I mean, I always had a very rich imagination. I would lose myself in the TV shows. I would, play it, dress up in my room and stuff like that. And so I always sought escape. And I shunned very overtly male guys, because I was intimidated by them. And I had a lot of gay friends. I mean, you're in the theater, you're gonna have a lot of gay friends. I'm very affectionate. I can be very campy. I always say, like, I'm a gay man in a straight man's body. I mean, I love movies, and I love musicals, and I'm very at home, with the LGBTQ community, because it 'cause it's nobody's trying. I mean, there's a lot of, co competition there, but it's a different form. But it's a community that values wit, that values humor, that values rebellion, and that is fueled by this sense of not belonging. I once had a discussion with a guy who has become a very prominent person in the gay community as a writer and as an actor, and he said, "You don't know what it's like to be a gay man." And I said, "Actually, I do. Because I was very close to my mom. I was intimidated by my dad. I used to withdraw into a world of fantasy. I loved old movies. I loved old movie stars. I loved dressing up in costumes. I hated sports, and I loved the theater." And he kind of sat for a second and went, "Okay, so maybe you can understand." So the point is that there is a societal aspect that has nothing to do with sexual preference. And what happened when I discovered, the first time I got drunk, I threw up. But the first time I got high, I felt disconnected from myself. I was very self-critical. "You're not tall enough. You're not good looking enough. You're not funny enough. You're not charming enough. Girls don't like you. You're not an athlete." It was all negative. And I don't even think that came from my parents. I think that's just the ism. I think that's just the disease. I didn't need my parents to lay that on me. I had it. I had it. And getting high got rid of that, and I either felt like I was funny, or I didn't feel anything. So the idea of being a man and what that meant, I didn't discover that until much later, because I didn't feel like I knew what that was. And the thing about recovery that's so amazing is you're able to develop a sense of yourself and your own personal worth, and it's not based on anything external. It is based on what's inside. We're all these broken toys that come into these meetings, and we're trying to kill ourselves. We're actively trying to destroy ourselves, destroy our lives, whether it's gambling, food, sex, drugs, alcohol, debt, what exercise, whatever your addiction is. But if I'm an addict, it means I have to find something outside of myself to fill and fix what's inside. And at several points in the play, the main character says, "Who am I without all these things? If you take away the drugs, if you take away the women, if you take away the alcohol and the guns and the action, who am I?" And that's the central question. But I think that's all of our questions. Who am I without my big house, my beautiful car, my big salary, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, back to that spiritual thread, right? That all comes back to finding that. For me, I always had awareness that it was holding me back, but it was like this kind of like low level disconnection. And yeah, I'm really resonating with everything you're saying. So what when is it coming out, and how can people find you if they want to hear more about where it's playing and how to get tickets?
Where you can go, so the play opens, the play, The Spy Who Went Into Rehab opens June 7th, and it's playing at the Pacific Resident Theater. And the way one would go to get tickets is Pacific Resident Theater, so PACIFICRESIDENT Theater, that's spelled the old way, theatre.org, PacificResidentTheater.org, or they can go on Gold Star, and it's available for a discount. And it's opening, as I said, June 7th, and it's set to run 6 weeks, but the hope is if we keep filling houses, then we'll run for as long as we can.
Incredible. Yeah, that's theater spelt the Canadian British way.
Yes, we spell it the Canadian Vision British way, yeah, but PacificResidentTheater.org.
Awesome. Well, we'll share all those links in the show notes. Anything witty you want to leave us with, Greg?
Well, I'm very proud that I wrote the theme song to The Spy Who Went Into Rehab, the last line of which is, "Can't gamble or wear a tux. Being sober totally sucks. The Spy Who Went Into Rehab."
Well, I really wish that I could come. Well, I'm hoping that it runs so long that I can come and see it before it runs out.
Or
And
we just tour Mexico and Canada. That's the goal,
yeah,
is
perfect.
for it to have success here, and then because it's short enough that it's the kind of thing that other theaters would find very attractive. And the thing about it that was really interesting, again, is that there were people who were from that community and not from that community who totally related. Because it is, we can all, we're an addictive culture. Everybody has something they're addicted to and hangs on to. So it's incredibly relevant from that standpoint.
Totally. And this intersection, like, if you in exchange recovery for, finding, feeling connected with
Yes.
the current reality of what it is to be masculine, and there's just so many extremely relevant themes there that I
Right,
confidence is going to be very
and what
successful.
it is, and also, women as well, balancing, especially, heterosexual women, what is the balance in a man that I am drawn to that is masculine but not macho, and that is sensitive but not soft? And that is, from the other standpoint, it's, what do I want from a partner who's a man? I can't speak to same-sex relationships because I don't know if that dynamic exists. It maybe it does. But I can speak to the heterosexual version of that, which is, and it's the same thing for a man. It's, I want someone who's nurturing and makes me feel safe, but isn't being my mother. It's like, how do we balance those things with each other? And I think it's all through communication, and knowing yourself, and knowing what your triggers are, knowing, well, this kind of person does this to me versus that kind of person. I mean, that's the journey we're all on, I think, when it comes to relationships, at least.
Yes, it all comes back to, I think, understanding ourselves on the deepest level and allows
Absolutely.
us to have, true connection and conversation.
True. Much like we're having now.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Greg. It's been an absolute pleasure, and
Thank you,
I'm sure
Megan,
we'll be
as
in
it
touch.
has been for me.
Hey there, one last thing I wanted to share with you. If you're enjoying this podcast, it would mean so much to me if you could rate and review it on your favorite podcast platform. It really does help us grow the show, and this being so important to me to get this message out to more women to help them optimize their wellness and ultimately their lives. This is my mission, and I would greatly appreciate it if you could support the podcast by rating and reviewing. Thanks in advance. Have a good one.